Case number 14-5055, Henry Kellogg Brown & Root, Inc. et al. Petitioners. Mr. Elwood for the petitioners, Mr. Cohn for the respondent.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court. A confidential communication between a corporate client and its attorney for purposes of obtaining legal advice about allegations that an employee engaged in illegal conduct is at the very core of the attorney-client privilege. The district court mistakenly concluded that a corporation loses that privilege whenever it has a policy of investigating such allegations or when it is required by law to report violations to the federal government. For two reasons, that conclusion was mistaken. First, the district court erred in concluding that a regulatory or corporate policy purpose is inconsistent with the existence of a legal purpose for a communication.
Of course, you're going to have to show more than this, that they were wrong,
right?
You hear on mandamus. And after Mohawk, there isn't much room for us in mandamus, is there? How do you surmount Mohawk?
I think that this is precisely the kind of particularly injurious privilege ruling with implications beyond the case at hand, which Mohawk contemplated.
Okay, let's focus on particularly injurious. What is particularly injurious about this?
I'd say two things in particular. First of all, it is a clear legal ruling which calls into question or withdraws the privilege from a broad range of materials which have traditionally been thought to be privileged. And given the increasing expansion of corporate reporting obligations and the like, and in a very real sense sort of sounds the death knell of Upjohn, and I think the uncertainty created by the
privilege. Why can't the problems with that be redressed with a post-judgment appeal? What Mohawk's telling us. We start there, right? The heavy presumption that all of the privilege matters can be and should be redressed in post-judgment appeals and not on mandamus.
I think a couple of things. First, the uncertainty here continues the entire time this would be pending, and not only KBR, but all of these companies that, filed this amicus brief, all the companies that are reading the articles written in the trade press.
They're not in this case, though, right?
But I think that is one of the bases for mandamus. We're in the case, and the sort of ill effects, the uncertainty, are the other thing. Now, you have to keep in mind that
this is a decision by a single district court judge, right?
It is a decision by a single district court judge, that's correct. But I think it's important to keep Mohawk in perspective because Mohawk wasn't a case about mandamus, although it also discussed that. It was a case about collateral order doctrine. And the comments it made about the adequacy of the remedy were set in the specific context of the alternative being, routine appealability of collateral order doctrine cases. And it said, as a class, this is an adequate remedy. But it said, mandamus would still be available for cases that are particularly injurious and with implications beyond the case at hand.
I guess
which
what
is
I'm
the reason
to get
why the uncertainty matters.
We don't have any guidance, at least from the Supreme Court or in our circuit, about what particularly injurious means. Now, you've got another prong here, right, and that's a particularly novel ruling. We'll get to that in a second. That may be a stronger argument for you, but I'm trying to unpack particularly injurious. What is there about the injury that would come from an adverse ruling on attorney-client privilege here that can't be taken care of on post-judgment appeal?
Well,
what is there about this case?
About this case is a couple of things. I mean, this is true, I think, always with privilege, and that you lose the privilege when you have to disclose it.
Mohawk tells us that's not enough.
No,
that's
Mohawk says it's not enough for collateral to justify routine collateral order doctrine appeals. It said mandamus is different, and it said that that there are particular injurious rulings. Now you have the Hernandez versus Tanyan case from the Ninth Circuit. You have City of New York from the Second Circuit, which was law enforcement privilege, and you have Perez.
So City of New York seems a little bit different. And I think this gets some of the questions that are being raised. So City of New York seems different because the injury that was the predicate for relief there was a sort of collateral injury because you might have the disclosure of undercover operations. So it wasn't the type of injury that you're talking about here, which is the unveiling of privileged information, period. It's not as if the unveiling of privileged information here has the kind of collateral consequences that would have been an issue if what you disclosed was undercover operations.
I would disagree. I mean, it's certainly not the same kind as in a disclosure of undercover operations because there you have particular law enforcement agents who are potentially put at risk.
Right.
But when Mohawk said implications beyond the case at the bar, we do have the question of the uncertainty created by this entire rule. In addition to this, you have the...
You mean uncertainty for other cases?
Uncertainty for KBR and uncertainty for other cases.
But no one has to follow the other cases. I don't want to interrupt, but no one has to follow the other... No one has to follow this case in the other case.
Well, the thing about it is that corporate counsel have to be prudent, and they have to go out there and look at it and see this case, and this is one of the things they have to take into consideration when they're advising their client.
Right.
In addition, we have the Hernandez versus Panian case, which says that it was particularly injurious there because it was found to be a blanket waiver of attorney-client privilege. And, you know, there they found it particularly injurious because they turned over all of the attorney-client documents, you know, because of one particular waiver. They said it infected essentially everything. And this is particularly injurious for precisely the same reasons, and that KBR has to turn over essentially its entire investigatory file on this case, which is, you know, the traditional injury, the sort of cat out of the bag. But it presents, anytime you have these sort of internal investigations, it presents a particularly acute risk of litigating at using the wits borrowed from the adversary.
So is this prong of the mandamus test always met? In other words, has to be a clear error. It also has to be, in essence, irreparable. Is the irreparable prong always met in an attorney-client privilege case?
I wouldn't say that it is always, no, because, you know, what Mohawk talked about is that in the run of things, you're going to have just fact-bound application of settled law to the particular facts of that case, and those are the sorts of things that are reviewed for abuse of discretion. They're unlikely to be overturned, but they're also unlikely to result in sort of widespread.
And the difference here is the test, the but-for test, is that?
Well, it's the but-for test. It's the fact that the judge treated the existence of a regulatory purpose or a policy purpose as being mutually exclusive with the need for legal advice.
But that goes to the degree of error, right? What does that have to do with the degree of injury?
Well, because it is essentially a blanket thing. It exposes the entire investigative file. Unlike this sort of fact-bound applications, which the court said don't routinely give rise to a mandamus review, what we have here is a very widespread harm resulting from the judge's broad legal errors that result in disclosure of the whole kit and caboodle, the entire investigative file. And that is, I think, makes this case particularly injurious.
So it's injurious to you. So we're only talking about this case at this point. And you're saying the entire kit and caboodle, meaning the entire kit and caboodle for this case, putting aside what happens in other cases.
Yes, putting aside
particularly
that.
Particularly injurious for you because absent the privilege ruling, the other side would have nothing. In light of the privilege ruling, the other side has everything. Is that effectively what you're saying?
I think that is effectively right, that just as in Hernandez, there was a blanket waiver, and that was considered to be particularly injurious enough warrant mandamus relief in that case. Here you have just defining that the privilege doesn't apply at all, and that makes it particularly injurious because it is turnover, you know, all of what we have, which, as I say, presents a particular risk of litigating with borrowed from the adversary. And it's particularly injurious in this particular case because, again, we have a plaintiff who arrived too late in Iraq to have personal knowledge of many material facts. He's only deposed three witnesses, not including the person who allegedly took the kickbacks. And, you know, if he is to survive summary judgment, in a very real sense, it will only be because of these documents.
So it's still a cat out of the bag injury. You're just saying it's an acute form of...
I think it is an acute form. I think it is an acute form. It is a very large cat, yes. Yeah. It is a very acute form, I think, of the cat out of the bag injury, which I don't think that Mohawk retreated from. It just said that sort of run-of-the-mill retail-level disclosures aren't going to be enough for collateral order doctrine. But when we're talking about sort of a wholesale injury here, I think that is what makes this case inappropriate.
On the clear error part of this, or the error part of this, it seems to me that the issue here stems from the primary purpose test itself, in that primary purpose implies that you figure out which is the most important purpose, and that crowds out any other purpose. And as you say in the brief, you can have multiple overlapping purposes, but we're stuck, aren't we, or are we not, with primary purpose test?
I think that the court applies the primary purpose test. I think that there were errors that the court made, because, I mean, that's just a test for the application of the privilege. But I think the court
also...
But
you want us to, as I understood the briefs, to go back, to send it back with application of the primary purpose test. And I think the district court started with the primary purpose test, and I actually think maybe applied it literally in the sense of you, if something's mandated by law, then that's one purpose, and that becomes the primary purpose. And maybe, I guess I would be interested in hearing what you want us to say about the primary purpose test.
Well, I think it's a couple of things, because, the way I read it is not that he thought that it was the primary purpose, meaning that once you have a primary purpose met, you know, everything else disappears, but also in sort of the application of the primary purpose test, in that he also made this error that we say that he assumed that essentially if there was a regulatory purpose, like you got to report this to the government. But he said on page 4 of the March 11th order, right, you know, this was only to help them decide whether there had been a violation. Well, in our view, that is legal advice.
But that's where he thought, and this is where I think some of the flaws maybe in the phrase primary purpose come in, at least from my review of the case law, which is he thought, well, if that's the purpose, that is the primary purpose, or legal advice can't be the primary purpose if that's the purpose, I guess is another way.
You know, I read it as, you know, but for. The other side argued in below that it was a strict but for test. And so I don't think it was because they thought this is the first purpose and it crowds everything else out. I think he just applied a but for causation, and because something else would have been enough for it, and I think this is met by the March 6th order at page 6, he says, you know, regardless of whether they wanted legal advice, he didn't say legal advice was subsidiary, he just said, regardless of legal advice, because there was a regulatory purpose, poof, it disappears.
And your argument is the regulatory purpose is a form of legal advice, right?
Well, in order to comply with the regulatory purpose, you may very well need legal advice, and we thought they did. Mm-hmm. And we think the primary purpose was to get legal advice.
Is that the particularly novel ruling that you're objecting to? Or
I think that the novel part of the ruling is but for, and I think that there's novelty in the fact that...
Well, on but for, do we have any precedent in our court that removes that from us?
Well, I think the primary purpose is inherently kind of contradicts that. And the case that this court relied on to adopt the but-for test is United States versus United Shoe Machinery Corporation, right, which quite explicitly says the but-for test is not appropriate. Mm-hmm. And this court has said but-for is not applicable in the related context of work product, mm-hmm, in the Deloitte case. But we think that there was a primary purpose for essentially two reasons. Because first of all, you have the fact that doing this regulatory purpose may require legal input. But secondly, this was a considered best practices long before this was a government requirement, because corporations are keenly interested in making sure that they have a handle on their legal liability, which is why KBR adopted this policy in 1989-90, long before it ever became a government requirement. Between those two things, that is the primary purpose, and there's also uncontradicted.
Is your view that everything in the COVC complex necessarily implicates the attorney-client privilege? Let me be a little more specific. Every time someone makes a report that triggers that process, are we necessarily in attorney-client privilege land, or are there things that are enveloped by that process that might fall outside?
I think there are things within that process that would fall outside. For example, you know, you would have to look at the documents and see whether they satisfy the particular purposes. But, I mean, for example, like if the attorney made notes on cases or, notes on legal authorities, you know, those obviously wouldn't be attorney-client communications.
Those are work product.
Yeah. It might be. Yeah. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that at least, you know, KBR had this separate process, code of business conduct.
They might be. What would trigger work? Why wouldn't they be work product under your theory?
If there was not a...
Your theory was that the sort of the specter of regulatory compliance and key TAM litigation meant that they lived...
Because you have to meet in work product, you have to have a subjective expectation that litigation is a realistic option or a real possibility, and it has to be objectively reasonable. And you just have to go through and you make sure those tests are met. Now, before I sit down, I mean, one of the things that Judge Kavanaugh said is, what do we do before we send this back? And I think it's important that I note that KBR is of the view that this case warrants reassignment on remand because of the judge's violation of Rule 21. Rule 21 was set up specifically so that judges would not take a role in mandamus, so that no matter what.
Did you expressly ask for that in the petition?
We didn't. Well, we didn't ask for it in the petition because the reason why we did it is because his reaction to it was the Rule 21 violation.
We
served it on him. That's when he came upon it.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is,
so it's not the ruling itself and the disclosure. It's the response to the petition. Got it.
Well, when we gave it to him is when he sent this document to the court, this extraordinary document to the court, where he says, these are the most important. May I continue, Your Honor? I see my time.
Please, yeah.
Even since then, there's been another order in the district court that's appended to our kind of our final reply, which is, in response to a routine scheduling order, a routine scheduling motion where the parties, just submit it to. It's the sort of thing that in the Southern District they just write, granted on the top. He went out of his way to say KBR filed this extraordinary petition and said it's understandable they want to, hold this evidence back because it's totally inconsistent with their summary judgment position. And again, that is a sort of gratuitous or sua sponte utterance that the court in Amico said was an indication. I mean, an impartial observer could say is a sign that the judge should be removed. As Alexander versus Primerica said, you're not held at that point to the 28 U.S.C. 455 standard. 28 U.S.C. 2106 is available. Liddicky versus United States approved that. I mean, it said that 2106 is available. And that is the standard that the court applied in Primerica, which is kind of the standard they applied there is just interest of justice.
So back to primary purpose for me, because I want to make sure I'm clear on this. If you have a legal purpose and a business purpose and they're completely overlapping, how does a court even begin to assess primary purpose? Maybe not completely overlapping, but largely overlapping.
Yeah. Well, I think in this case, I'll tell you the reason why I think.
Ask not just this case. If we write an opinion as you want, that will have impact.
No, I appreciate it. But, I mean, this is one point along the spectrum. And, I mean, I think that the court has to look at the reasons why in that case the communication was made. And in this case, there were essentially two layers of legal advice. The legal advice necessary to know whether you have anything to report to comply with the regulatory obligation, and the pre-existing, larger purpose, again, these kind of programs were a best practice long before they were a regulatory requirement, which is that companies have a real, pocketbook issue for them as legal liability. I've been in cases myself where literally there were billions of dollars at stake based on allegations of attorney misconduct. And you want to know the answer to that. And that is the reason why there's undisputed or uncontested testimony from Chris Heinrich in our reply appendix, page 91, and in the opening appendix, page 58 to 59, saying that the reason why they had this was to get legal advice, because they had to know what is the legal ramifications of allegations of attorney misconduct. Now, there's no dispute here either that when these tips come in, there's this initial determination made by a lawyer in KBR's legal department about whether they go to the code of business conduct side or whether they go elsewhere. And if they don't raise code issues, they go elsewhere. They're not overseen by a lawyer, and they are not for the purpose of producing legal advice.
So is your argument that any time they go on the code side, they're going to be protected?
I think that any time you would still have to go through and see whether.
You answered your earlier question. You talked about specific instances where maybe a particular expression would not be protected, but are you telling us that anytime it goes to the code side, we're in the land of attorney-client privilege?
We're in the land of attorney-client privilege, so you have to, there may be particular documents that aren't covered.
Regardless of the mix of legal business motivation? Or?
Because the thing is, business motivations and all the rest, if it's that alone, it goes elsewhere.
Right.
But if it goes here, the whole reason
that alone, your key word there was alone.
Yeah.
Right. But the whole reason why they have this is because they need to know what the legal implications are.
So getting at the primary purpose question, I mean, are we talking about what percentage of the purpose when it goes on the COB side gets attorney-client privilege protection?
I think, I'm a very literal guy. I'd say, 51% if it's two issues or, 34 if it's three. But I think that, admittedly, if there were some case where it did this, the business purpose for something just totally swamped it. I think that we would have a much harder case.
At that point, you might say that it's not a primary purpose. I mean, it seems like some of this is semantic because the question would be, is it enough for the purpose to be a primary purpose, or does it actually have to be the primary purpose in the sense that you're actually evaluating most purposes and trying to figure out whether there's only one that actually dominates over all the others. If you have a test that asks whether something is a primary purpose, then as long as the purpose of seeking legal advice or facilitating legal services are a primary purpose, then that would be enough to trigger the privilege. At least that's one way to look at it.
I think that is one way of looking at it. I would be happy with...
Do our cases foreclose that way of...
I'm sorry?
Do our cases...
No, I don't believe so.
...applying the primary purpose test foreclose that way of...
No, I definitely don't believe so. And I think that in our case, we could say we'd be happy with the primary purpose test because we believe that the primary purpose of this investigation, I mean, after all, it was a code investigation into allegations of fraud and False Claims Act litigation.
If that's true, then I think you should win under but-for, under your argument,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because it's it seems to me that for you to say that you can win under the primary purpose, what you're saying is it's always for the purpose of securing legal advice. I don't care if it's under the umbrella of a regulatory apparatus. It's for the purpose of securing legal advice, which would be true of but-for also.
I think, though, that reflects the judge's second concern or second error, which is this idea that the presence of a regulatory purpose makes the legal advice disappear. That, you know, he said this, you know, it seemed to be in both of the orders that he said that, you know, the minute there was a regulatory purpose, it was as though you don't have to look at anything on the other side. He doesn't even bother addressing the testimony of Chris Heinrich. You know, he just treats it as a given that, you know, once you have a regulatory purpose, that's all there is.
Well, I think the idea was that if you have one purpose, it crowds out the other, whereas, in fact, maybe they're overlapping purposes. I mean, I think that's the issue that Judge Srinivasan's question gets to as well, which is if we write an opinion here, we are going to be setting a precedent that people are going to follow carefully, so it's going to be important to get the semantics exactly right on that and not just
Are you sure you want one where it's the primary purpose, 51%? That's
well,
what you said.
I think that it seems like
a big
improvement.
I know you understand. You believe that's the facts of your case. But
I think that's a big improvement from where we're coming from. Obviously, I think if it were, you know, a primary purpose for a, you know, repeat litigant that is, you know, would very much appreciate being able to keep its privileged communications privileged, I think that a primary purpose, you know, would be preferable still.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll give you back a few minutes. Mr. Cohn.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. A writ of mandamus under the standards set by the Supreme Court in Cheney v. U.S. and Mohawk Industries is simply not obtainable in this case. Cheney says that as a condition of mandamus, you must have irreparable harm. And Mohawk.
You heard Mr. Elwood's argument about the particularly injurious prong, that on the facts of this case, losing the attorney-client privilege right now builds a case that you don't yet have, in effect.
Well, that would go to something that could clearly be corrected on appeal. And if you look at Mohawk and its instruction, it is crystal clear that errors that can be corrected on appeal.
But it also preserved mandamus. It's expressly preserved.
Yeah,
that.
What does it mean, then? What does particularly injurious mean if it doesn't mean giving the case away to someone?
Well, I think the post-Mohawk decisions are instructive. That is informant's privilege, intelligence records, but not attorney-client privilege, because Mohawk took a lot of time explaining how you can address those type of concerns.
Was the Ninth Circuit case an attorney-client privilege case, Fernandez?
The Ninth Circuit was that, and that's an interesting case because it was Mohawk came down just a couple of days before oral argument, and they spent only one little paragraph on the issue of irreparable harm. I think that they were still in the collateral estoppel.
But Mohawk hasn't eliminated attorney-client privilege.
Not at all. It has just said that there's an avenue to address an error.
So your understanding, what would be the type of adverse attorney-client privilege ruling that survives Mohawk for mandamus? How should we be thinking about
well,
that?
Well, the closest they have, and I don't think it actually it would survive Mohawk, is what you saw in that 2010 case out of the Ninth Circuit, which was this very blanket waiver. But if you read the facts of that case, the judge was talking about just total waiver, and including the waiver of specific legal advice and legal opinions. Whereas in our case, the lower court did exactly what the lower court should have done, which was reviewed the documents in camera, and then determined upon an in-camera review that none of the documents contain specific legal advice. So the question you have about the or a, I think this judge dealt with it. He began with an analysis of what's the primary purpose. He looked at the law that required this, but I viewed he looked at it as a factor. Because he also
identified, just to play this out, there was a corporate policy, that was a problem. There was the regulatory structure, that was a problem. It was in-house counsel, that was a problem. There weren't warnings given to the employees, that was a problem. The problem I'm having as I assess this is I don't see precedent supporting any of those four factors as being reason to sideline Upjohn in the traditional Upjohn rule.
Well, I think what the judge did was reviewed a series of factors. KBR's argument that
I think there are a number of them, but I don't see that any of them, of the four I just listed at least, is rooted in prior case law. I think it came from his application of the but-for test, and I understand how that got started. But
I think his review of the non-disclosure agreement, which every employee signed, and that non-disclosure agreement not only was the message to the employee, but it also was a signal of why KBR was doing the investigation. Doesn't mention attorney-client at all. It mentions business purposes. It actually threatens an employee with the ultimate business decision in their life, termination, if they discuss the fraud issues with anyone. It talks about KBR's business reputation in the Middle East. It talks about sensitive, not attorney-client. An attorney-client is only referenced in where you go if you want to tell anyone about the fraud allegations. I view that as intimidation, and in the record, the attorney said that no one had ever gone and asked for that permission. Why would a lowly employee say, hey, can I discuss my fraud with the Department of Justice or that Quitamera later? So that's a statement of intent, but this is what the judge did, and I think there's absolutely no error. He didn't predicate it on the mandatory nature. He looked at those factors, but then he did the next step, which I think was required. He looked at the documents themselves, and that would give him the opportunity to make selective withholdings. That would give him the opportunity to make selective withholdings. And then he makes a finding that after doing the in-camera review, there were no opinions sought, no opinions given.
Well, but all, sorry to interrupt, but all this stems from him, the starting point of the but-for formulation, page 5 of the March 6th opinion. And there's no case of ours has used that formulation, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that would alter significantly the Upjohn privilege, because it does, in practice, seem to equate to a sole purpose test. In other words, unless legal advice is your sole purpose, you're not going to find it privileged. I think that's how it would play out in practice, which would be a big change.
Yeah. Sorry. If the judge applied a sole purpose test, then I think your argument would have great weight. But he did not. I think in reading the decision, he begins with analysis of primary. He ends with the conclusion it wasn't primary. He uses but-for, so it's more in line with the way the Supreme Court was discussing but-for in Barrage. Just a term of causation, a way to explain causation.
He says most importantly, the investigations were undertaken pursuant to regulatory law and corporate policy rather than for the purpose of obtaining legal advice. Most importantly, so that's the most important consideration he's looking at.
And I think if you read the decision as a whole and the follow-up decision denying the certification for interlocutory review, that is what lands him to the primary purpose test. Because of the government mandate, this investigation was per se intermingle business.
Well, suppose you have a situation like this, that a company decides for its own purposes that it wants to facilitate an environment in which it's made aware by its own employees of wrongful billing practices. And so it erects an architecture that establishes that. And then the regulations come along, or then they come into their first encounter with the regulations and they say, oh, well, it turns out actually that based on these regulations, because we're now undertaking an agreement with the government, we have to do something like what we're already doing. And then they investigate it and they say, okay, well, what we're doing already complies. And so therefore we just continue what we're doing. And then you have the same set of facts come up. Would you say that the primary purpose, or the most importantly, they were undertaken pursuant to the regulatory mandate? Or even though they already had a system in place?
I think what you're talking about is a level of proof. Before you even get to primary purpose, you have to show there was essentially a mixed investigation. If this was just done by the legal department, and one of their cases was a legal department case, if this was done pursuant to KBR's own regulations, where they could have triggered a strictly attorney-client review, different case. But
what I'm saying is it's the exact same process that they have now. It's just that it was already in place before the regulations ever come into the field of vision. And then I think it just seems odd to me that the question whether the attorney-client privilege applies turns on whether the company's policies were in place before or after, which is, I think, where you'd have to go under the district court's analysis. And that just that seems puzzling, that it would actually turn on the sequence in which the...
Your Honor, I think that when this judge did his analysis, he didn't end with mandatory program, no attorney-client privilege. Mm-hmm. He started with that. And you have to start with that because once it's a mixed investigation, once KBR voluntarily decided to commingle these two processes, now the burden's on them. Mm-hmm. They have to show the primary purpose was legal. Then what the judge did is he looked through traditional Upjohn analysis. He looked at the program itself. He looked at what the employees were told. And he determined, yeah, this looks primarily. Then he did what I think is the most important thing in the case. Because now you're weighing. It's a balance. Clearly a balance. He then does the in-camera review. And he looks at the document. And then he makes a finding based on the in-camera review, which is no legal purpose.
The language of the order speaks in much more general terms than the case-specific reasoning you're doing. I mean, he takes an approach to corporate investigations, in-house investigations, that's much broader than what you're describing right now, and saying that if it's a compliance investigation, it's not going to be protected by attorney-client privilege.
No, he never says that. KBR says he said it over and over, but he did not. If you read the decision, he doesn't say it. And if you look at his order denying the interlocutory review, if there was confusion for other lawyers or other companies caused by the October 6 order, when he does his denial of the interlocutory review, five times he says this is a case-by-case analysis, depends on particular circumstances, this case raises discrete issues. Fact dependent.
But the key fact then is the mandated compliance with the regulatory program, or a key fact.
I don't think so, because if you read the March 11th order, that's where he comes straight out and says the in-camera review resulted in his words, none of the documents requested legal advice, none of the documents offered legal advice. Reports written with no litigation have been filed.
Says the court concluded that the primary purpose was to comply with federal defense contractor regulations, not to secure legal advice. And you talked about a balance. My problem with this is that I don't think it's a balance, because I think they're overlapping. In other words, yes, I want to comply with the federal defense contractor regulations. Of course you do. But it's also... substantially legal advice as well.
It's a sandwich. At the beginning, before you start, you have to show a mixed investigation even to get to primary purpose.
Right.
Then you got the meat. That's the analysis of primary purpose. What employees are told. what the in-camera review reveals. Then you have the last piece of bread. Once you determine that the primary purpose was not legal, he concludes that the primary purpose wasn't legal. The primary purpose was compliance with the federal regulations.
And my issue is, why isn't that legal? Why isn't the desire of a corporation to comply with regulations, why isn't that, in fact, at the very core of seeking legal advice? You go to your lawyers and say, federal regulations require this. I want to obey. We want to obey. How do we do it?
Because that's not what happened in this case. The investigators wrote the questions, not the lawyers. They cite to a case, Limon, which they cite to as supporting them, and Limon concludes.
Well, look, Upjohn has told us that the gathering of facts and a compliance investigation is part of the process of advising the client. So I'm not certain that distinction is a significant one.
Yeah, but in Limon, the court held, the magistrate and appellate by the district judge, that the CBOC witness statements were not obtained by investigators for the primary purpose of preparing litigation, ordered them produced. The judge in that case and in the other cases did the in-camera review and said, oh, this one and that one. Most of the cases they cite to, the court looked at it in camera and said, oh, well, this will be withheld, this will be produced.
But the in-camera review isn't going to save a flawed analysis. If in-camera review is being conducted through the lenses of unless a lawyer is directly involved and unless legal advice is taking place in that very conversation, it's not privileged, that doesn't help any, right?
The suggestion is
that perhaps the district court was wearing the wrong lenses and that when he saw corporate compliance, he did not think that was part of the process of
No, no, I think
advice.
It's part of the meat of the analysis. For example, the judge now looks at all of these non-in-camera facts and says this looks like an investigation under CBOC. It doesn't even mention attorney-client. However, let's make sure. He opens it up and looks. If there was a document that said, we're looking at a potential case, or
what he sees are facts, and the facts are what Upjohn, as Judge Griffith says, is the first step in any good investigation is to gather the facts. So he saw facts. But that doesn't tell us anything.
But in those documents, words could have existed, which they didn't, that indicated, they gave any indication of a legal purpose outside of just doing a compliance investigation.
So you're saying that has to appear in the document itself?
No, you're looking at the situation as a whole. You're trying to reach a determination. Why was that interview done? Was it done primarily for a legal purpose or as now required under federal law?
And what I'm saying is right there, the or doesn't need to exist there in your construction, right? Is it done for a legal purpose or done to comply with federal law? Why can't those be one and the same?
It can be.
I think
be.
That's KBR's argument.
It can be, and in the facts of any specific case.
If there's novelty to this ruling here, that's the novelty, right?
But
separate the two.
But the judge did not come out with a per se rule, period.
So here's what the judge said in the March 11th order, which I think you think is the critical one, right? At page 4, which I think is 8:13, at the end of the investigation, the investigator drafted a final memorandum and submitted it to the general counsel's office. But the memorandum does not request legal advice, and it does not identify possible legal issues for further review. So you're happy with that part of it. And then he says, instead, the memorandum was created to help KBR decide whether it needed to report kickbacks or contractor fraud to the United States. And I think one way to look at that last sentence is to say exactly. Because the fact that it was created to help KBR decide whether it needed to report kickbacks or contractor fraud to the United States is necessarily part of the apparatus of seeking legal advice and legal counsel on what do I need to do here given the overarching rules that govern. And now that's his case-specific application. He's saying, I'm applying these standards, I've looked at this document, and here's what I think this document does. And I think one reaction to that is, well, that seems to be speaking in terms of legal advice.
And that is why KBR cannot meet the clear error standard for mandamus, let alone others, because KBR had a specific rule in place in this case, and the judge was looking at that rule that set up the entire process. KBR set up a process that was divorced from giving legal advice. They actually have a section that says why we do the investigation.
I think my point might be just the opposite of what you said, or at least I'm trying to make the opposite, which is that the last sentence says, instead the memorandum was created to help KBR decide whether it needed to report kickbacks or contractor fraud to the United States. And it starts with instead, as if that's different from seeking legal advice. It wasn't for the purpose of seeking legal advice. Instead, what it was supposed to do was to help KBR decide whether it needed to report kickbacks or contractor fraud in the United States. But one way to look at that sentence is to say that instead is just wrong, because the fact that it was created to help KBR decide whether it needed to report kickbacks or contractor fraud in the United States is seeking legal advice. It has to do with legal advice. It's all about the process of obtaining legal services to understand what do I need to do to comply with the law.
And the next paragraph is the primary purpose was to comply with contractor regulations, not to secure legal advice, which is the legal overlay, making the same contrast that Judge Srinivasan just talked about on the facts of this case. And that is there any case that says that you're aware of, that compliance with, if you're trying to comply with regulations, that's not seeking legal advice?
Your Honor, it's yes. All of the other, most of the other cases they cite to, mm-hmm. where the courts did the in-camera review, and one in particular where they found that all the witness reports in the COBC were releasable, none of which went up on mandamus or were even appealed to the best of my knowledge. The judges looked at it like a district court should and made a judgment. But there's something much more, I think, kind of overriding, which is, if you look it up, John, and the way the company structured that investigation. You know, clearly there's hundreds of ways to structure an investigation, and Upjohn doesn't set up the only way, but it's instructive. If you look at what KBR did, KBR set up this structure divorced from seeking legal advice. In the COBC rule, it lists the five things.
Just to incorporate into your answer, wasn't Heinrich part of setting it up, a legal official?
Again, so what? A lawyer sets it up. A lawyer can wear multiple hats. The mere fact that something goes to a lawyer is not dispositive. But more important, the director of COBC held the position director COBC. They say he was a lawyer. So what? Lawyers can be directors. The COBC rules did not require that the director of COBC is a lawyer.
Do you think a corporate counsel, though, one of the primary, maybe I shouldn't use that word here, but one of the jobs of a corporate counsel is to ensure that the company is not violating the law and to conduct factual inquiries routinely to ensure that the company is not violating the law. Do you agree that's a part?
Yes.
And that's a legal function?
Yes. And any time KBR wanted to do that, in this particular one in a thousand COBC investigations, they could have, but they didn't. This is what COBC rules say the purpose of this investigation, these documents.
You, as I recall from your brief, you seize upon one sentence on page 9 of the COBC report. But what is the procedure you're referring to?
This is on RA-19, section B.8. Which we'll try to make sure that's the reply appendix of the response.
This is investigation of violations?
Yes.
Okay.
And what it says is it tells you what it is. It says persons authorized by the policy committee to investigate. It doesn't say a lawyer. Then it says evaluate such information as to gravity and credibility. The investigator, the security investigator, did that. Initiate an informal inquiry or formal investigation. We already know that the security managers
You're saying you're now describing that there were two procedures that KBR had, one that would get the privilege and one that wouldn't.
Okay. There's actually one procedure.
Yeah.
What you're looking at here, this is the standard operating procedure. This is what occurs in all cases. They have another procedure.
Yeah, where is that other procedure?
Okay, that procedure is...
Because I don't think Mr. Heinrich talks about another procedure. I don't...
RA 18.
Yeah, you refer to the sentence, such procedures shall provide for obtaining advice of legal counsel where appropriate. At least that in your brief.
Exactly.
That's what you
stress. And that's in there. It says the policy committee shall establish such procedures.
And my understanding of your argument is this refers to the KBR, the COBC had a procedure for following investigations that would get the benefit of the attorney-client privilege, right?
Absolutely they did, and in Henrich's deposition,
maybe
he said they didn't invoke.
Maybe we can hear about that, because I don't remember hearing anything about that in Mr. Heinrich's
And in Mr. Henrich's deposition, when he was questioned about this, he confirmed they never went to the policy committee for this rule. Mm-hmm. So this obviously a company needs to get attorney-client information. There's nothing in the judge's decision or in the rules that prohibit it.
You're saying there was a road they could have gone down, but they didn't follow that in this case.
Absolutely, and that's a fact-specific piece of this puzzle, why it's best in the district court. But if you turn the page, which I think is even more revealing, which is on the reply appendix 19 at B8, this tells you what the purpose of the investigation is. They easily could have put an E saying attorney-client. They easily could have done it, but they did not. This is the binding policy set and sent to the Securities and Exchange Commission. They tell the SEC what they are doing to have reasonable investigations. This is a public document shared with shareholders, shared with the Justice Department. This isn't just something that a lawyer
drafts
up.
Of course, it could be an assumption that the attorney-client privilege applies because it's a corporate investigation, right?
But that's not
enough. We'll hear from them.
But if you look at the purposes set forth, it says investigate, evaluate, informal inquiry or formal investigation, which they did, prepare a report of the results. It doesn't say prepare a report for recommendations to the attorney confidential. Disposition by whom? Doesn't say. Then it goes, recommend changes to the COBC
okay,
where necessary.
I think we have your argument on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Okay. Mr. Elwood, we'll give you 3 minutes. Used everything up. Yeah. But you'll keep talking as long as we ask questions. So.
There are just a couple of things I want to touch on. Subject, of course, to whatever the court wishes to address. But one of the matters that the opposing counsel discussed was whether people would be aware of the fact that they were giving this information mm-hmm. for purposes of providing legal advice. And there, I just want to walk the court through some of the things that indicate that they would have understood that that was the purpose. To begin with, the actual communication that they're seeking to uncover, which includes the memos of the witnesses, memorializing what was said during the investigation. Most of those had a legend at the top, attorney-client privileged information. So right there, you know, that is the communication, the main communication they're trying to seek, and it says
right
there.
That's for the witness statements?
Those are witness statements? It's on most of the witness statements.
And under the witness statements, when the witnesses are making the statements, did it have that stamp on it? In other words, that stamp wasn't put on there afterwards.
No, it's actually written on. It's not a stamp. It's actually written. It's a word processor document that's included in the word processing thing. And in Mr. Barco's own statement, which he had in draft and turned over to us, it says that at the top of it.
So you're saying the witness, when making this statement, had this in front of them to see?
Yes, okay. Most of them would have had that. Most. In addition to that, you have the fact that the code of business, they're talking to code investigators about the fraud issue. And the code is kind of a creature of the law department. If you look at the code, the COBC, and you see who to contact in the back, 13 of 19 names on it are people, lawyers in the law department. In addition to that, the brochure, which they get every year, says that fraud investigations are undertaken under the direction of the law department.
What about the point Mr. Cohn was making that there's separate procedures? There was a procedure you all could have followed, KBR could have followed to get the benefit of the
verifiably, it is Relator's invention, and it is disputed by the only evidence in the record. The thing he points to is this thing, and it's page 840 of the Barco appendix, and it's point B2, and it says they have this procedure for obtaining legal advice. If you then look at pages A101 to 102 of the same appendix, it's the Heinrich deposition. Counsel points Heinrich to that and says, where is that procedure? And he said, that's the procedure we did here. So that is among the testimony saying that the procedure they have to obtain legal advice is what was followed here. I also wanted to go over the much maligned confidentiality statement, which is at page 828 of the same Barco appendix. And it's also in, I think, the bottom of page 3, or it's in the first order. But we view this as an Upjohn warning for laypersons who are not legally sophisticated. You know, this is for people, you know, who are working at an army base in Iraq. And this doesn't just, you know, threaten them with termination. It says, due to the sensitive nature of the review, they understand that it's confidential. I further understand that the information I provide will be protected and will remain within the confines of this review, and only authorized personnel will have access to it. I understand that in order to protect the integrity of the review, I'm prohibited from discussing the particulars regarding this interview, absent specific advance authorization of who, not their manager, not somebody else, but of the KBR general counsel. And I think that this is enough to put them on notice, along with everything else, the entire regime that's been built up in wake of Upjohn, the COBC, the brochures, et cetera, to let them know that what it was. I think it's not law, it shouldn't be lost on the court, that one of the people interviewed, Barco, what did he do, you know, promptly after leaving KBR, he sued us, which is a pretty good indication that he understood that the investigation, you know, had sort of risk of lawsuit written all over it. The tip that was quoted in our brief, one of the tips that came in from a guy who went by the name Fred Flintstone, anonymous tip, said, you know, from what I understand, the feds are coming, the feds are going to be all over this. So I think it was clear to everyone that this was undertaken for purposes of legal advice because of real risk of legal liability. If there's no further questions, we'll rely on our submission.
The case is submitted. Thank you.